This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about maps, specifically the book All Mapped Out, How Maps Shape Us, published by Reaction. And this, as the title suggests, looks at maps, but also how they impact us socially, culturally, on a whole bunch of levels and a whole bunch of interesting ways. So I'm very pleased to have with us the author of the book, Dr. Mike Duggan, to tell us all about it. Mike, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Miranda. I'm very happy to be here today to talk to you about the book.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this?
Yes, of course. So I'm a lecturer in digital culture and society at King's College London in the Digital Humanities Department. But my background is in cultural geography. So thinking about it's a kind of subdiscipline of human geography, thinking about how different cultures interact with the world, these kinds of ideas. And I've ended up in this Digital Humanities Department teaching largely modules on, social media and the economy or AI and society. And I'm trying to think about maps with my current kind of teaching context in mind. So I don't do much teaching on maps in my day-to-day work, but I'm trying to incorporate those ideas into my research on maps, which has primarily been the work that I've done so far. So the book was an attempt to bring my ideas about maps into this kind of current context around digital culture and society. I think that's a brief summary. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's a good starting place and to situate it within that context of teaching and digital humanities. Is there anything further we should know about sort of the aims of the book and anything you'd like to tell us about how you developed these?
Yeah, of course. So the book itself is really aimed at a general audience. So the plan here was not to reproduce another academic monograph. It was really to have an academically grounded book which is applicable or appealable to a large audience. So there are, references and lots of footnotes in the book, but really it should read as if, you can walk into the shop if you're interested in maps in a general sense and take away some ideas about some of the academic debates that are happening in map studies. So, you know, true scholars of maps will notice many gaps, and there'll be many inconsistencies, I'm sure. But that's not really the point of the book. If people are interested in that kind of work, they can look at my academic papers and my other academic books. This is really to take some of those ideas and see if they kind of gel well with kind of general views about maps or general interest in maps. There's been quite a lot of books for general map enthusiasts, but most of those books have been geared towards, you know, these are 10 maps which shape society, or these are 10 really beautiful maps, or that kind of coffee table, I would say coffee table market, which isn't really going beyond the map itself. So, you know, it's saying these are well-designed maps, or they look great, or these are some significant maps throughout history, but it really wasn't getting in touch with my research interest, which is largely around, you know, how and why we use maps themselves.
That's a helpful explanation of kind of where this fits in and perhaps what sorts of readers might want to take away from this. So thank you for giving us that kind of big picture foundation. I'd like to now get into some of the details of the maps and the sort of impacts that they have, and start with, I think, to me, it kind of made sense that this was a starting point. It's often where at least my mind goes, thinking about kind of how we actually use maps, which is the London Black Cabs, who famously kind of have to memorize incredible amounts of information to know where everything is and how to get from point A to point B. How does that kind of knowledge and understanding of maps and use of mapping differ from other people? Like, are they doing something completely different than the rest of us? Or is it just the same sort of thing, but more extreme? You know, help us understand what this kind of iconic thing is regarding maps and how it relates to other mapping practices.
Yeah, sure. So there's a chapter in the book which is all about navigation. So thinking how do we navigate with maps, and what does that mean in a social and cultural context? So I started with this sort of passage on black cab drivers in London. So I spent a lot of time with them to see how they use maps or didn't use maps as they went from A to B in London. And this is really a way of looking at the idiosyncrasies or subjective experiences of navigation with maps as a way to kind of extrapolate out a little bit and say, hang on, we all have quite different ways of using navigational maps, even though we all may use the same navigational map. So I wanted to take a look at black cab drivers to see how this general kind of knowledge assumption that they know all the streets of London and they can get from A to B without any problems, to see what that was like on an individual case-by-case basis amongst drivers. So there's this one guy I spent time with called Dennis, and he had been a black cab driver for, I think, 20 years or so, and really, you know, knew the streets of central London, particularly that, you know, 1 mile centre section really, really well. And I was asking him how he used maps, and he kind of, you know, was saying like, he doesn't really use maps at all anymore when he's driving the streets of London, but he would use maps all the time if he was in a different city or in a different country. So it was really this site-specific, use of or not non-use of maps in this context. And it made me think about, you know, how was he navigating? So what was he doing in terms of his kind of cognitive functions as he was picking up passengers and taking them across town? And he began to talk as if he was kind of replaying the A to Z map that he learnt the London knowledge test on. So he would talk about how, you know, when I asked him to go from, I think it was Old Street Station to Hyde Park, he would think about it as, he would take my destination and kind of put it in a top-down view in his head. And he would break up the sections of London road network into different shapes. So he would think about Hyde Park as this long kind of rectangle on the left of the map, and then a series of interconnecting triangles and semicircles along the main routes along Aldwych and the Strand to get us to that point. So even though he wasn't using maps anymore, the way that he had trained himself to do the knowledge test using the A to Z is kind of, you know, embedded on his kind of navigational abilities. And it just shone a light on, okay, I've never really heard of this kind of shape mapping kind of cognitive practice before. And it's very, very different to how I would use, for example, Google Maps to get from, you know, between those two same locations. So this started a journey really to think about, okay, if we're all using the same app, what kinds of techniques and tricks and cognitive actions are we taking when we're using these things? So I, you know, took that idea of the cab driver, worked a bit with Uber drivers, finding actually they worked in a very different way to Dennis in the black cab. So much more reliant upon the interface of Google Maps, you know, in front of them while it was in the car. So it was really taking this kind of small example and extrapolating it out a little bit to think about, you know, different subjectivities around navigation.
A really interesting starting point. Thank you for taking us into the brain, I suppose, of a London cab driver. If we stay on this aspect of navigation, you have a great sentence in the book that the daily act of finding our way is, quote, a petri dish for examining the power of maps in practice. Can you take us through this?
Yeah, of course. So the, you know, I'm sure many listeners will know, but the power of maps is now a well-trodden phrase, this idea that, you know, all maps convey or reconvey a sense of power by those that produce them. So if we take, you know, our most commonly used map today, Google Maps, I suppose, you could argue that the power of the Google map is that it reflects the interests of Google. So it represents largely commercial interests, it represents places that they can tie to advertising revenue, and it doesn't reflect other things like locally significant places to people necessarily. So if you think about, you know, very small acts of using the map, for example, to get across town from A to B, how the power of the Google map shapes that experience. I was interested in that idea. So I would accompany people as they went around their errands around London for a couple of years to get a sense of how was this power being kind of influencing where they went or how they went about what they did. And the way that it emerges is in navigational points. So people know they have to follow the blue line on Google Maps to get there, but then they may say, oh, I've just passed the Pret a Manger or I've just passed the Museum of London or something. And these are things significant to Google Maps' view of the world, and they're directly influencing how people are getting from A to B. Whereas, you know, let's say we're walking through parts of South London, some locally significant places to people would be something like religious places of worship, for example. These things aren't really identified on a Google map, particularly at the layer of navigation. So the power of Google Maps in that sense is operating in a different way. It's not showing or not highlighting these kind of other sites of interest to the navigator. Is that what you mean? That was one example I was mm-hmm. thinking through. Yeah,
that's a great example. I suppose it relates as well to kind of something else I wanted to ask about, because even just that particular instance, some of those points that people might use to navigate don't necessarily change that much. Often places of worship, for example, might be around for quite a while, but is that shopfront a Pret or is it something else is perhaps more likely to change? How do we think about maps and the power of maps and what they do or don't represent when the situation or the reality that they're representing is changing, is in flux?
The dynamism of the world isn't easily captured on maps, even though we use maps as static forms to tell us about what's happening. And I think a good example of this is the pandemic or war reporting. So both of these things would, you know, maps are heavily influential in how the public was seeing what was happening, where. And they often you have different maps every day being updated to respond to what's happening. So if you remember the Johns Hopkins mapping dashboard that was very popular during the pandemic to show us, you know, on a map where, you know, large outbreaks were or where outbreaks were, you know, increasing or decreasing. Often this map was being, you know, reproduced through news outlets every day and a new version of it was being updated. And in this sense, there was a kind of strong correlation between things were developing very, very quickly in the world and the maps are responding as a result of that. But this idea that the map is static and does tell us about, you know, what is happening, I think if you look at other areas, this kind of persists, this So this link is a bit more stable. So if you think about maps for walking, for example, people often assume that, you know, the OS map of the Scottish Highlands would probably much more or less be the same as it is today, except for the different, establishments that are in those places. But the mountains haven't moved, or the footpaths have only moved slightly. I think in those situations, there is a more of a trust in, okay, this is the map which shows us the landscape or the earth, and therefore the earth doesn't move often that often. So this map, 10 years later will still be more or less useful for what we're doing. So it really does depend on the context in which a map is being used. If a map is being used to kind of convey or understand, geopolitical events or events like the pandemic, that requires a different form of engagement with a map as a static object, compared to maps which deal with more, concrete or slower moving ideas.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I do think, particularly given the last few years, we perhaps have more appreciation of the different responsiveness of maps in the different situations. I wanted to ask, though, not just about kind of the dominant maps, the maps that do get on the news, or the maps, embedded in our phones, whether that's Apple Maps or Google Maps or whatever. You also talk about in the book counter mapping practices, where marginalized groups subvert some of these dominant narratives. Can you introduce us to some of these?
Yeah, so counter mapping has been around for a little while now, and it's also linked to participatory mapping. And the idea is that you get a bunch of people together, or as a cartographer, you work alone, and you kind of counter the normative understandings and ideals of maps. So this could mean, changing the way that the map looks. So if we think about the situationalists in the 1950s in Paris, they literally cut up maps, rearranged maps of Paris to kind of provide a different spatial understanding of what was happening. Then there are cartographic counter maps. So, for example, if you're a community which is being subjected to let's say a massive regentrification or regeneration in your urban setting, you may use cartographic counter maps to counter some of the impacts of that. So you may have a community organization that brings people, local people together to say, what does this place mean to them? What will regeneration do to that, those associations, those meanings? And then using that counter map as a form of evidence in a, participatory planning meeting to say, hang on a minute, maybe you should rethink this or that based upon this form of spatial evidence around, what this place means to people. There was quite a lot of this in South London around 2010, when the Elephant and Castle regeneration was going on. So this is a massive area of South London being regenerated. It's more or less complete now. And lots of people were displaced from this area. So first of all, from the famous Haygate estate, but then from the surrounding areas. And there was groups of grassroots organizations coming together to think about how to challenge some of this. And mapping was a part of that. So they would have these sessions in community halls where they asked people to come and, tell us about their relationship to this place in London. And then using that in, public consultations with the council and also the developers to say, this is what will happen, or this could happen if you plan to regenerate in this way. The power imbalances were, in this case, skewed towards the council and the redeveloper. So in the end, these efforts, although they were useful on the day, I would say didn't necessarily lead to meaningful or significant changes for those people affected. But there are other examples where things have been very, very successful. So if we're thinking about mining and how mining affects many indigenous communities around the world, there's been lots of efforts to try and use counter mapping to fight, for example, illegal mining, or related would be kind of illegal deforestation. So, getting people together to say, what does mining do to affect your relationship to the local area, to your local community and space and place? And then using that as kind of legal evidence to say, actually, this is illegal mining activity, or this is illegal deforestation. And then kind of using these maps through the courts to try and get something done about it. And there's many examples of there being successful legal battles, not just based upon the map, but as a, you know, using the map as part of an evidence body to get things changed.
Those are some really interesting examples. Thank you very much for kind of introducing them to listeners. I sort of want to ask about something I feel almost maybe I should have asked you about earlier. I don't know. We've already talked about some of the examples, and I think we do take it so for granted. That's probably why I didn't ask you until now. But I want to make sure we don't kind of continue that, or I don't continue that. Obviously, maps are no longer just on paper. There's a whole bunch of digital maps. We use them probably way more than on paper ones, but the paper ones haven't disappeared. And there's links between how maps used to be developed and how they are now. Can you walk us through how some long-standing map cultures are adapting to digital mapping technologies and the experiences of using digital maps?
Yes, sure. So if we just go back to kind of walkers for a minute. So I did a bit of work with the Ordnance Survey around the time that they were kind of transitioning from a kind of semi-private company, partly owned by the UK government, to a solely private company, which they are now. And they were struggling, as you might expect, with the digital transition. So they're a company famous for, you know, paper maps, largely used for kind of leisure purposes, but they also had this commercial arm as well. And they're thinking, you know, how do we maintain this kind of, you know, brand of being the UK National Mapping Agency that people can trust, particularly on kind of, you know, as they're walking, while also transitioning to something kind of digital. So there was lots of experiments with new forms of app, you know, navigational apps, but also apps to guide users to particular, you know, sites of interest along their walks, these kinds of things, or providing additional information to those walks. So not just giving a route, but also providing a kind of guidebook as well. So, you know, this is information about some of the sites you might see on your walk, or these are some things you might want to visit as you're, you know, you're using these maps in towns and cities. They're also experimenting with different forms of movement. So not just walking maps, you know, they're trying to produce apps for cyclists as well as walkers, or for different forms of transport. So, you know, road cyclists, gravel cyclists, these kinds of things. And I think in the end, they realized that there was a market for, you know, the paper map for hill walkers, right? This was something which people still wanted to use, and therefore they should have kind of embraced that a little bit more. So people still like this association with the paper map and walking. And this could be for a number of reasons. It could be, you know, nostalgia, but it could also be to do with that our phones aren't very good at keeping signal in some of these places, or they may have the potential to run out of battery. This kind of, you know, trust in the paper, trust in this kind of older mechanism from getting to A to B. Or it could just be a more of a social and cultural thing that, you know, they don't want to use their phones in these environments. They would rather engage with the landscape using the paper map because it's a different form of engagement. And this could be linked to, you know, things like the digital detox movement. People don't necessarily want to use the technology, even though it's there. They want to try and engage with the world in slightly different ways, particularly, you know, during leisure time. There's also some interesting things happening as a result of this understanding that paper maps are still something that people want. So we see these personalization maps, or personalized maps, that you can now order directly from places like Ordnance Survey. So if you have a map that you really like of your local area, you can now get that map based around, you know, your local routes. This can be something you can, you know, use for navigational purposes, or something you can, you know, frame on, put on your wall to say, this is my local area, this map is kind of personally made for me. So there became this almost gifting market around this, where there'd be nice Christmas presents or interesting birthday presents to give people, which it wouldn't have the same feeling if you sent them a digital file version of the same kind of map, because we're all used to having that now today. At the same time as there's been this kind of, you know, blurring of the digital and the paper in this context, there's also been a much bigger drive to think about geospatial data as a valuable source of income for some of these companies. So if we take Audit Server as an example, really I would suggest, you know, most of their money, most of their income now comes from, you know, acquiring geospatial data sets, creating geospatial data sets through direct surveying, and then selling that or licensing that for commercial uses. For example, if you're building a new town or a new, you know, development, you may license some of this geospatial information as part of your planning application or as part of the construction itself. So knowing, you know, what's going on where in the ground is really important information if you're building a large development. And this is something which is happening all over the place, kind of behind the scenes. As a commercial user of, you know, sorry, an everyday user of maps, you don't really get to see this, you know, this market. All you get to see is the interface that you're using to get, you know, from A to B, for example. But there's a whole, you know, market in the acquisition and selling or licensing of geospatial data, which is largely the untold story of this transition from paper to digital.
I think that it's so interesting to kind of think about the complexities of it. It's not as simple as sort of, oh, we're switching from one to the other. It's like, well, actually, hang on, there's an overlap here that I think maybe we often don't think about in terms of technological aspects, but as you've just demonstrated, well worth discussing. So thank you for that. I do want to ask, though, about kind of what new things might be possible because of digital mapping techniques. So given that you've just told us about sort of the transitions or not or overlap between them, what if we move into like the kind of, I suppose, purely digital mapping side of things? Are there new mapping cultures and practices that are being created rather than looking at evolutions of existing ones?
Yeah, of course. So I'll talk about maybe two examples, one leading on from that previous discussion. So if you're, you know, building a new development now, often you have to submit a digital version of what the thing is going to look like once it's complete. And there's two ways this is being done. One is a kind of aesthetic version. So if you walk past a new building development, a large one today, often it shows you what the thing is going to look like before it's built. So it'll have, you know, children playing and then some people sitting around drinking coffee, these kinds of things. And I would argue this is a form of mapping. So it's a kind of 3D geospatial representation of what is going to happen or what is happening. And then alongside the aesthetic kind of marketing version of that, there's also a much more technical version of that, which you might use if you're, for example, installing utilities in that development. So there's a whole, you know, world called building information modeling or BIM or digital twins. And this is this idea that you are recreating a reality in a digital form, but it's technically accurate. So, you know, what you see on the screen relates directly to, for example, where something is happening on the ground. So this is important if you want to install a new, you know, gas pipe into a building, or you want to understand where you can put foundations in the building. So there's all this kind of thing going on, you know, for some time now, and often it's now a legal requirement that you submit this information in a digital form to a planning council, to your architectural firm. So that is something which I would still class as a mapping. It doesn't look like a 2D map that we might be used to. It looks more akin to kind of the 3D layer of Google Maps. But when I think about mapping, I think about it as a spatial representation of what's happening on the Earth. And to me, it doesn't matter if it's 2D or 3D. It's still a form of spatial representation. The other example I want to talk about is to do with autonomous vehicles and the way that they see the world now, which I would argue, again, is a form of mapping. And some vehicles are using LiDAR scanning technologies. Some vehicles are using different kinds of sensor technologies to understand the world around them. So the way that I've talked about this in the book is thinking, you know, about perception. So how does a self-driving car see the world as it drives through it? And it's literally mapping it as it goes along. So as you drive your Tesla, or as you drive your, you know, Waymo car, what the car is doing is using a bunch of sensors to understand what environment it's passing through. So it's using often machine learning technologies connected to LiDAR to say, this is a tree, this is a person, this is another car, this is the road layout ahead, this is what kind of weather we're experiencing at this moment. And it's calculating all of those things in real time to make decisions on what that car should do. So if, a ball, for example, that some kids have been playing with gets kicked into the road, in theory, the car should recognize the ball as a ball in advance of it becoming a problem for the car or for the child that may be running onto the road to pick it up. So it should stop. And it's doing this by looking at lots of images of balls to try and make an association between what's in front of them and their database. So if it recognizes that it's a ball based upon its database, then it may make a decision to slow down, to swerve, or to stop. So as well as it happening in real time, it's building up a large database of geospatial information, which can be used by other self-driving cars or feeds back into kind of the bigger data storage of the company which is developing these tools. So I would say, yeah, both of those look very, very different to, the 2D map that we might be used to, but they're still representing the spatialities of the world in a graphic form. And therefore, I would say they're a form of mapping.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. We don't want to be too wedded to kind of an assumption of here's what maps have to look like, rather than thinking about kind of, well, what are they used for and how are they used? Perhaps a broader kind of category there. Given especially those last few examples around kind of self-driving cars and use of different technology, what do you think are some possible mapping futures?
Okay, so I think maybe I'll talk about this in three ways. So I think that will continue at a pace, particularly because artificial intelligence has this kind of trendy baggage associated with it today, which attracts lots of investment. So I don't expect there'll be any end in sight to car companies or mapping companies claiming to use AI to generate new forms of perspective or new forms of spatial understanding of the world. So lots of mapping companies that are claiming to use AI, or lots of companies that claim to produce the most advanced, geospatial understandings of the world, this is going to continue at a pace for as long as the hype of AI is around us. We see a lot of this in what's called geo-AI. So companies using large geospatial data sets to predict what might happen or what has happened. So if you think about climate scientists are using this quite a lot. So thinking about how has the climate changed based upon what's happened before, and how can we kind of build models of prediction which have a mapping outcome. We see this too in things like agriculture. So, taking large satellite imagery databases, using AI machine learning to understand what has changed, and then using that to predict what might change in the future. So there's a whole field of kind of geo AI, which is already worth billions of dollars, and are likely to continue at some pace. I also think that while all this is going on, the analog map or the paper map isn't going anywhere fast. I think there was an assumption for a while that we would just make this smooth transition from the paper to the digital. And that just clearly hasn't happened. There are many examples to say that we now exist in a world where both of these things happen simultaneously, and perhaps always will do from now on. A good example of this is the transit maps. So people still like having an analog transit map attached to the side of a underground station or next to a bus stop. There's something about being able to see it in front of you at the time that you need it, which works better on that large format, large printed format, than it does, kind of using your phone to zoom in and out of different stations. And this is the reason why, you still see, tourists and locals use the London Tube map while they're waiting for their train, or that's the thing that people look at when they're staring above rather than at each other on the London Tube. And this isn't just about London, it's the same thing is happening in other places around the world where transit maps are, play this big role. As I talked about earlier, paper maps for walking and leisure, this will still continue. I think there's some estimates that paper map sales are on the rise again. So I think we shouldn't discount the value of the paper map. And then the link to that is this, the map as an aesthetic object. So people have always enjoyed, you know, looking at maps as a kind of object of beauty or an artwork. And that is, again, almost gaining pace again. And we saw this during the pandemic. There's many people on, you know, Zoom calls with their maps proudly displayed behind them as they were talking. Or the world of map art and kind of how that is now being used, you know, in commercial purposes to sell people maps to put out and put on display in their homes. Again, some of that isn't new, but also I suspect that some of it is a response perhaps to this, the kind of omnipresent digital map that we're now used to having access to in our pockets. And then I also want to think about other ways of designing maps themselves. So rather than thinking about mapping as always this kind of cartographic, scientific or professional practice, we begin to see many more amateurs get involved in this idea of you know, what map is or how they could produce a map. And this has brought together many different styles of mapping, which aren't necessarily cartographic or scientific. So we have people like artists experimenting with different forms of map or using the 2D, two-dimensional map and kind of presenting it in new ways. There's a great project called the Dreading the Map project, which I talk about in the book. And this idea was using the map to convey ideas about colonial expansion between the UK and the Caribbean. So the group involved were all a bunch of black and brown women with kind of Caribbean heritage, and they would literally dread paper maps of the passage from the UK to the Caribbean, and they would kind of situate them in the RGS, the Royal Geographical Society's map room, which is a famous map room where lots of kind of colonial explorers are kind of adorned on the walls, and they would kind of construct sculptures of these maps to show the links and connections between the people and places involved as a way to convey new ideas about the spaces and kind of events which happened during that time. So, you know, they were using two-dimensional maps, but certainly presenting them in a way which is way beyond how we consider or conceptualize the 2D map today. And then finally, I could talk about the amateur. So this, the idea of the amateur getting hold of maps or getting interested in maps for different reasons. And this has been happening for a while now, but we see people coming together to produce maps as a form of leisure activity or form of community practice. And this is really popular in the humanitarian sector. So I spent a bit of time with a group called the Humanitarian Open Street Map Team, and their job is to produce maps in response to humanitarian disasters. So if there's been an earthquake or there's been a political disaster or a geopolitical disaster, they may produce maps which kind of show devastation or destruction before and after an event has happened. And then the maps can be used by people on the ground to identify where to direct their aid. So it's a very kind of altruistic activity. But the amateurs involved in producing those maps are often people in the global north coming together with other like-minded individuals to kind of pursue an interest in maps, but also to do something good for the world. So to give something back, which isn't just, you know, their donations or their money. It's more, you know, a time commitment. So at these events, they're often called mapping parties. So, you know, people get together, there's beer, there's pizza. And it's a social activity in as much as it is a kind of altruistic mapping activity. And with, you know, free to use online mapping tools, these kinds of things are, again, continuing at a pace. The same thing is happening in kind of citizen science world. You know, maps are a key part of the infrastructure of those activities because they provide different forms of engagement or ways to engage new audiences like families or young people rather than, you know, your kind of professional cartographers or professional scientists.
Lots of very interesting things to look out for, and I don't know, maybe listeners will want to go look up these mapping parties, for example, and learn more about them. Even for listeners, however, who may not jump in at that particular point, what do you hope any reader of this book, or maybe any listener to this interview, might ask themselves next time they pick up or look at a map?
Yeah, it's a good, great question. I think I would like them to just look at it in a slightly different way. So when you pick up a map for, you know, to go from A to B, or just pick up Google Maps out of your pocket, rather than think about it as a tool to get you somewhere or a tool to give you some information, it'd be nice for readers to think about where, you know, how is this thing being presented to me? What were the decisions made to get this thing into my hands? So almost, you know, who is producing the map? What are the reasons why they're producing the map? Why is it that I've got hold of this map at this particular time? I'm interested in, you know, where a map goes after I may have used it, or how does a particular map get circulated in society or distributed in society, and who is responsible for, you know, influencing which maps we use in what context? So it's thinking about maps in the kind of contextual sense, rather than as a practical tool or a piece of technology. And this is related to much of my other work around technology and society. Often technology is understood as a tool, and really it should be understood as a kind of contextual social object or social process, which really changes depending on who we're speaking to or how we're looking at it. So let's just pick, you know, if we pick Google Maps again is the obvious one. It just seems natural now that we take this map out of our pockets on our phones to get to where we want to go. But I think thinking more about, okay, why is Google providing this map to us for free? What kind of maps are being represented to us when we're using it? What kinds of perspectives or views of the world are we seeing when we're using it? And how might someone else in the same position as me use this map? Are they using it in the same way? Or are there slight quirks or differences in how we might use the map itself? And really, once you start, you know, talking to people about how they use maps, all these things kind of emerge quite quickly. There's this general assumption, I think, that we all would approach Google Maps in the same way, whereas really all these kind of little tweaks and nuances begin to emerge when you just ask someone, you know, how is it that you're using Google Maps? And this is, again, I think in terms of technology, related to many or if not all forms of digital technology which are popular today. We're treated as if we are universal users or the ideal user. Whether we're using, you know, a social media platform or a food delivery platform or a mapping platform, the way that we are sold this kind of universe experience doesn't match up or doesn't kind of reflect the realities of how we use these things, which is much more kind of an individual or culturally specific way.
Definitely some interesting things to think about. And I'd love to pick up on that thread of kind of how it relates into your other work. What are you working on now that this book is done?
Good question. I'm actually not thinking about maps at all anymore. I'm thinking about tact. Tact as a social and spatial process. So I'm interested in what tact is. I think we often assume, again, we understand, you know, a general or common sense understanding of tact is that it's this kind of sensitive form of engagement with someone else, a sensitive form of touch. A good example would be, you know, saying the right thing or not saying the wrong thing in a certain situation. For example, at a funeral, you know, don't say something too, that's going to, know, be insensitive to the person who's been bereaved. So we understand tact in society in that way. But having done a bit of research now, there's many other ways to think about tact. So tact as a form of judgment, tact as a form of or the thing which happens between theory and practice. And I'm trying to take these ideas, particularly tact as a form of judgment between theory and practice, and trying to apply that to artificial intelligence and machine learning, and thinking about how outcomes or decisions are made by these technologies in the world, whether it be self-driving cars or other types of AI technologies. So I'm trying to develop this concept of tact as a spatial concept. So tact modulates what TACT modulates things that happen in space or shape spatial relations between people or between objects. And this is, you know, really just the start of a new project. And it's at the moment taking a lot of time going back through the kind of work in psychoanalysis, in educational studies, to understand how TACT has been understood. Because it, in my discipline of geography, it doesn't really get much of a look in, but it has a long history in psychoanalysis, pedagogical research, as well as in music itself, thinking about TACT as a form of timing. So I'm basically sort of going through the history of the concept here to kind of find or discover the links between how it's been defined and how we can use it as a spatial concept today.
All right. Well, that sounds very interesting. Thank you for that preview. And of course, while you work on figuring out the spatial dimensions of TACT, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled All Mapped Out, How Maps Shape Us, published by Reaction. Mike, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Miranda.